This is a special edition of Making Waves, a National Ocean Service podcast for news and information about our oceans, coasts, and Great Lakes. This episode is designed to provide you, members of the media, with additional background on two of the six presentations that are part of the upcoming NOAA-sponsored symposium, Decoding the Secret Pathologies of Dolphins, Significance for Human and Ocean Health. And that panel is scheduled for February 19th at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. First, we hear from Dr. Laura Schwacke about a new study that finds that bottlenose dolphins living in the estuaries along the Georgia coast have the highest levels of polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, ever reported in marine wildlife. Then we hear from Dr. John Ramsdell about new research that shows for the first time that exposure of laboratory animals to a harmful algal bloom toxin can lead to a permanent state of epileptic disease. The following are excerpts of recent discussions with these two scientists recorded by telephone. Each segment is presented in the scientist's own words with no interruptions or additional narrative. And as a reminder, this information is embargoed until February 18th, noon Pacific time. We begin with Dr. Schwacke. We started the conversation by asking her why her team decided to study dolphins along the coast near Brunswick, Georgia.
There have been reports from this area of PCBs in particular, and also mercury and toxicine in the biota in this area. Most of these related to several Superfund sites in the Brunswick area. And we were interested in finding out if we're seeing levels of PCBs in lower level marine biota, what would be going on at the top of the food chain with dolphins. So that's why we started looking at dolphins in the area. And I think what we're seeing down there is an artifact of being so close to the source.
We try to start with minimally invasive techniques for the dolphins. So we began our study with boat-based photo identification surveys to identify individual dolphins in the area, and we conducted remote biopsy sampling. The remote biopsy sampling is done from a boat using a dart so that we don't have to actually catch or restrain the animal. The dart collects a small sample of skin and blubber, which we separate for different analyses. The skin is analyzed for inorganic contaminants such as mercury, and genetic analysis is also done using the skin to determine the sex of the animal and for stock identification. The blubber is analyzed for organic contaminants such as the PCBs and organochlorine pesticides.
So we anticipated finding high levels, but the levels we found were just incredibly high. The median concentration was about 430 parts per million, so that's several fold higher than what we've been seeing in other sites along the U.S. coast in dolphins. The median concentration in males was 430 parts per million, in contrast to other male dolphins sampled from along the coast. Their contaminant values tend to run, you know, maybe 50 to 100 parts per million, so these were significantly higher. They were even higher than levels that we're measuring or that have been measured in transient killer whales from the Pacific coast. These are the pods of killer whales that feed on other marine mammals. So you know, they're at an even higher level of the food chain and have before been reported as having the highest levels of persistent contaminants in wildlife. But these dolphins have beat them out with even higher levels. What surprised us even more is after we had done the sampling down in Brunswick, we decided to move up to an area about 30 miles up the coast, the Saplow Island National Estuarine Research Reserve. This is, you know, a beautifully scenic area, very little development in the area. And we originally moved up there thinking this would be a control site, that if we wanted to investigate the health impacts of these contaminants, that this would be a good control site. So we did some remote biopsy in that region too. And we found that levels in that region were also around 140 parts per million, which is higher actually than has been seen in most other U.S. coastal sites. It's still lower than Brunswick, significantly lower than Brunswick, still higher than what we anticipated. The highest levels that we measured in Brunswick were over 2,800 parts per million, which as far as we know, that's the highest level of PCBs that's ever been measured in marine wildlife. So after we got the results back from the biopsy and we realized how high the levels were in that area, we decided to conduct a capture release. And there were really two motivations for that. Number one was to look at the potential adverse health impacts that were associated with these contaminant exposures in the Brunswick dolphins. And then also to do some radio tagging of the animals in Saplow, because this raised the question of whether the animals in Cephalo were moving down the coast, you know, up and down the coast, and that's how they were getting the exposure to the PCBs, or whether the PCBs were actually being dispersed through the coastal food web, and that the dolphins in Cephalo were remaining in that area, but they were still being exposed. So that was a big question for us. We found that there were a few males that moved up and down between the two sites, but there were also a majority of the animals that stayed within the areas where they were sampled.
A number of adverse health effects have been associated with PCB exposure in both humans and animals. The primary effects include lowered immune response, which can cause increased susceptibility to disease, poor cognitive development, liver damage, and impaired reproduction. Also, some PCBs are endocrine disruptors and can alter levels of thyroid or reproductive hormones. So there's a number of reasons to be concerned about the high levels of PCBs that we're seeing in these dolphins. So far, we only have preliminary results back from the health assessments, but we're seeing evidence of suppressed immune function, altered levels of thyroid hormones, and elevated liver enzymes. There have been a large number of studies that have examined PCB-related health effects in experimental animals, and even several that have looked at effects in other marine mammals, such as seals or sea lions, that can be more easily studied and evaluated. But the studies to date on cetaceans are very limited due to the logistical and ethical constraints for studying whales and dolphins. Also, pretty much all dolphin populations are exposed to some degree to persistent contaminants such as PCBs, which makes it more difficult to identify specific health effects because there's very little gradient in exposures. So it's been difficult for scientists to get a firm handle on how much of a risk these contaminants really pose to the health and sustainability of cetacean populations. Because this population along the Georgia coast has such incredibly high levels of PCBs, it's a good opportunity for us to study and understand the impacts that PCBs can have specifically on cetacean health.
Well, the implications for people are that, you know, it appears that there's high PCB levels in the coastal food web. We don't really know what the implications for the coastal populations are going to be, but this has certainly been enough to spur on further investigations. In August, at the same time we were down there doing the dolphin health assessments, there was another group that was doing an ecological assessment in the area and catching fish, and we're testing those fish for the same contaminant. We're testing several different species to see if there's certain prey species that might be associated with the high contaminant levels, and that, you know, could give some indication for the coastal community that eat many of the same types of fish, whether or not they could be being exposed as well. Also,
a pilot study is currently planned by researchers with the National Center for Environmental Health, which is part of the CDC. They want to examine environmental contaminants in residents of nearby coastal communities to understand whether coastal dolphin populations and human communities sharing the same seafood resources experience similar chemical exposures.
I guess the main thing to take away is that we have to be careful with what we're doing on our coast. I mean, these contaminants have been banned in the U.S. since the 1970s, yet, you know, here we're seeing them at incredibly high levels in dolphins, and the health of these dolphins is being impacted by them and could be impacting the health of people that are consuming seafood in the same area. These contaminants don't go away. They last for generations. So I think what we have to think about is that the pollutants that we're allowing to seep from our coast into the waters today are going to be around for decades to come.
That was Dr. Laura Schwacke, a wildlife epidemiologist and biostatistician and principal scientist for NOAA's Oceans and Human Health Initiative Center of Excellence at the Hollings Marine Lab in Charleston, South Carolina. Next up, we hear from Dr. John Ramsdell. We began the conversation with him by asking about the kind of algal bloom toxins that may lead to epilepsy.
These are very common algae. In fact, as opposed to most of the harmful algal blooms, which are composed of dinoflagellates, which are thought to be more the rogue type of plant cells in the marine environment, these toxins are made by diatoms, which are generally thought to be fairly benign and very productive parts of the marine ecosystem. They may not all produce domoic acid, so you might have some Pseudonychia australis in one part of California waters that is producing. You might have another one, another part that's not. And the general thought is that these diatoms start to bloom when there are these coastal upwellings. And these upwellings, coming from the cold weather patterns and the winds, when you're current, they will drive down towards the Channel Islands. you know, as they move around in those countercurrents of the Channel Islands, they sort of get held up many times, for example, like up in the Santa Barbara Channel, and they concentrate. But they also then get input from nutrients from land, for example, from runoff, and they'll start to use all these nutrients, particularly the silicate, which is important for their glass shell, which is characteristic of a diatom. And once they've used all this up, they sort of get stressed. And it's thought that the domoic acid is produced when they've gone through this big growth spurt, and all of a sudden they've used up all their nutrients, and then they start pouring out the toxin. And we've had probably about 10 years of these poisonings of sea lions and other animals in the area, including dolphins and whales. And so scientists at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito started looking at all this data. And they found that some sea lions were stranding with domoic acid symptoms at times when there were not blooms. Simultaneously, they had been following many of these animals in their clinics for an extended period, and they'd find that after an animal recovered from its acute seizures and seemed to be okay, all of a sudden they would start to develop epilepsy again. And this was interesting because there was one individual from the 1987 poisoning in Montreal who, a year later, seemingly having recovered, actually started showing seizures, and the clinician, you know, diagnosed them as having epilepsy. Now, after that case, you know, scientists tried to confirm that domoic acid actually could cause epilepsy, and they were unable to do so. But the findings of the sea lions in California made us think that we really have to revisit this and see if domoic acid truly will have this long-term effect to induce epilepsy. Sea lions are a good animal to give an indication of what's happening to other marine species because the sea lions are well adapted to the ocean environment as they are to the terrestrial environment. So when they strand, they can be cared for. They can go back to clinics and they can actually live in the clinic facility as easily as they can live out on the Channel Islands, really. And so they make very good subjects to follow the disease. On the other hand, a whale or a dolphin that strands has very poor likelihood of surviving much time at all out of the water. So the only information we have on these animals is the toxins that we can measure either in their urine or in their feces. And we do know that these other animals do strand during harmful algal blooms, and they do strand with very high levels of domoic acid. We simply do not know very well what the long-term consequences of the domoic acid are in them. And we have to use the information that we've gleaned from the Marine Mammal Center on the sea lions, as well as our own research in laboratory animal models. Well, rats, first of all, were chosen because they're a fairly standard model for human epilepsy work. And there's a process in rats that's called kindling. And kindling is sort of like if you take the example of kindling a fire, where you put a little bit of heat and eventually fire just sort of puffs up. And this is pretty typical of what you would see with a person that shows a seizure, where they sort of have this kind of convulsive behavior. They might kind of temporarily lose a little consciousness and then come out of it and maybe not even know what they had done or where they'd been. And so we know pretty well that domoic acid will do this. What we didn't know was the long-term consequences of this. And so what we had to be very careful with domoic acid because it's a toxin and it also, you know, is lethal. And I think the reasons the previous work did not work well, the previous attempts to show that domoic acid could induce epilepsy, was that it killed the animals before it could cause enough damage. And so we used a very small doses, just, you know, as you can imagine, to make a good fire, you have to kindle it carefully. You just can't throw a big flame and hope that everything sort of burns up at once. And so we very carefully kindled these animals with the domoic acid. And once we got the first sign of a seizure, we withheld the domoic acid and we just babied the animal through this bout of seizures. And then we took really, you know, very careful care of it for the next week. And then they pop out of it and they're really pretty good. And after that time, then we would watch them by video recording and just sort of see what eventually happens. And what we found was that over the course of 6 months, 92% of the animals became epileptic. Now, when we talk about epileptic, what we're saying is that these animals have both spontaneous and recurrent seizures, meaning that these seizures just sort of come out of nowhere, and they keep on getting worse. when there was obviously no toxin present. You know, it's been known for some time that substances like lead poisoning can lead to epilepsy and the likes, but I would say it's most certainly the first incident of experimental evidence that a toxin produced by harmful algal blooms can do this. Domoic acid is kindling the fire, but it's not the kindling itself in the fire that causes the damage that the fire causes. It starts doing its seizures on its own. Although in a broad sense say that domoic acid causes epilepsy, it's really the damage that domoic acid causes. And so that's why it's interesting and parallels to human epilepsy as well, because even though environmental agents causing this, the environmental agent is doing something similar to almost any other thing that would cause epilepsy. For example, we know that in humans, epilepsy can be caused by high fevers during childhood. The high fevers cause the damage, and that leads to the epilepsy. We know that brain trauma in a person can lead to epilepsy. Once again, it's the damage from the brain trauma. So the real common denominator is the damage to specific areas of the brain, and there are multiple ways to cause that damage to lead to this. In terms of domoic acid poisoning from seafood, most seafood is monitored pretty carefully, but it's very unusual to get enough domoic acid in seafood to make a normal person sick, particularly a healthy person. Overall, domoic acid is particularly a risk to those people who have problems with their kidneys or advanced age, but generally it's not a big hazard to healthy people. You know, I think first of all, what's being observed in the sea lions and the other animals is giving us an unexpected view of human epilepsy in some of the most magnificent animals of the oceans. And I think by decoding both the wildlife information as well as and working that within experimental data to understand what's going on will really answer a lot of interesting questions about, one, what's happening to dolphins and whales that we're not seeing in the ocean, and give us new clues to understand how oceans and the health are intertwined, because they clearly are. Harmful algal blooms are a natural phenomenon, and they're going to happen. However, it's quite likely that, you know, human influences do prolong them. For example, pollution provides nutrients that can prolong their growth and problematic effects. They won't cause them, but they'll prolong them. Likewise, the destruction of wetlands is a very big factor. You know, wetlands are the filters for many of the natural nutrients as well as, you know, poisonous things that come off the land. And when one lacks these filters, once again, you're going to enhance the effects. And those could well be contributing to the more intense blooms and more intense animal mortality events that we're observing. So there are practical measures from the management side that can be done. And, of course, there is research. There is research to better understand really what are these long-term consequences so we can better address them. For example, wildlife managers really wanted to know whether or not this neurological disease was result of repeated poisonings, because we have more frequent harmful algal blooms. And our experimental data answers that question, and it says no, because we find that just a single bout of seizures is enough to cause epilepsy in 92% of the animals within 6 months.
That was Dr. John Ramsdell. Ramsdell is a research physiologist and chief of the Harmful Algal Blooms and Analytical Response Branch at NOAA's Center for Coastal Environmental Health and Biomolecular Research in South Carolina. He's a toxicologist and an expert on the consequences of toxic algae. Was this a useful product for you? How can we make it better? Let us know at nos.info@noaa.gov. And you can keep abreast of the latest National Ocean Service news by subscribing to Making Waves at oceanservice.noaa.gov, and you'll find it on the iTunes Store. This is Making Waves from NOAA's National Ocean Service.